And I like to sing the dynamics too. Low, slow, sort of pathos filled first two lines, and then boom! And then we get all excited and sing up from the gravy rose. At least that's how I like to sing. It has been since February the 12th since I occupied this pulpit on a Sunday morning. It is so good to be back. I love this sacred desk. And I could come back with no better sermon than to think about the resurrection. Now, this sermon's going to be a little different than what you usually get from me. Next, the 30th, you'll get more of the expository preaching that I like to do and you like to hear and expect. But today I want to be more topical as it looks at the resurrection. And I'd like to walk all the way through the crucifixion and resurrection to give you strength in your faith. There is no part of the story of Jesus that is more attacked than the resurrection, and rightly so. Because you see, the resurrection is what distinguishes Christianity from all other religions. In fact, it goes even farther than that. You'll remember that Jesus in John 14:6 said, I am the way, the truth, the life. Now, if you know your grammar, you realize he's saying, I'm the exclusive way, truth, and life. But if you didn't get it, in a typical Hebraism of repetition, he then adds, no man cometh unto the Father but by me. So either that statement is true, and there is only one true religion, or it's a lie, and it's not and Christianity is not a way at all. It's just bogus. Now, Jesus, as early as the marriage at Cana, began preaching his resurrection. It is hinted at in Psalm 16. And so the resurrection becomes the key point. It is the means whereby we either verify the true deity and humanity of Jesus, or we discount it and we cast Christianity aside. So hopefully this will give you some strength. I remember teaching a portion of this for the very first time at Purdue University in the Krannert School of Business. It's one of the graduate buildings. But we used it every Friday night for classes put on by a Christian campus ministry. And one of my lessons was on this resurrection. Granted, I've learned a little bit more about it since then. So why don't we take a look at it today and recognize it's one of the devil's chief targets. If he can get you to doubt the resurrection, he has pretty well ended it. Because remember, how does a man get saved? First of all, he is saved by turning on the microphone. How's that, Becky? Much better. She's much happier. A man is saved by believing that Jesus is the Lord and that he was raised from the dead. If you don't believe those two things, that Jesus is the God-man come to die in our place on Calvary, and that he's not dead but alive because he raised from the grave, you can't be saved. So you can understand why the devil would want to go at these things. In fact, when I have felt what I thought was a demonic or devil attack, where I began to think, well, am I really right in this? Am I really sure? Every time my answer was this, devil, if you can explain away the resurrection, I'll listen to what you have to say. But I know he can't. I know he can't. Well, let's go down through there. Up to Sunday, we want to set the situation. Jesus is taken a prisoner in the garden there, betrayed by a friend with a kiss of affection. How very, very sad. And yet, Jesus has already identified that he would lose none but the son of perdition, and we now know that to be Judas. He would then be taken through a series of trials. He's taken first to Ananias' house. He is kind of the Jewish high priest. He's out of office as far as the Romans are concerned. Then they take him to Caiaphas. Now, Caiaphas is the Roman-approved high priest. And he's put through a trial there. He is then sent to Pilate. Because, you see, the Jews could not do capital punishment, although they seem to forget that with Stephen when they start throwing the rocks. But they want him crucified, and the only way to do that is to go to Pilate. Pilate examines him, finds he's from Galilee, sends him up to Herod. Herod examines him, sends him back to Pilate. And as we looked at Thursday night, three times Pilate seeks to free him by saying, I find no fault in this man. But the leaders and the crowd convinces him to have him crucified, going so far as to say that he's not really a friend of Caesar's if he does not put Jesus on the cross. And they make a trade. Barabbas is let loose, who is a truly wicked man. And Jesus, who was completely innocent. We say we're innocent, but we mean of one situation. We don't mean completely. None of us are. Romans 3:23 says we have all sinned and come short of the glory of God. So not one of us can claim innocency. But here Jesus is put on the cross, having done nothing wrong, thought nothing wrong, said nothing wrong in his entire existence on the planet. Now he goes through these trials, and Pilate, in the midst of his trial, says, well, maybe if I could just, I'll scourge him, and hopefully that'll be enough. So they sent him for scourging. Now let's see what scourging is all about. Scourging is in the Jewish faith. You can do that. You cannot whip a man more than 40 times. So the Jews always did 39. In case they miscounted, they would still be in obedience to the law. I think they're missing the point. But this wasn't a Jewish lector that was doing this. This was a Roman. Now, the Roman used it, had a short handle and then long straps. They would put on those straps little pieces of glass or metal. And on the end of the straps were lead balls. And as he would take the cat of nine tails and lay it across him, the straps would cut into his back while the rest of the strap came around. The lead balls would crash into his chest as it was bruised, because you see there was nothing in the way because they had his hands above him on a hook to a nail above him. So he was wide open. And they said they usually used two. One would go, then the other one would go. So they'd get both sides. Over and over and over and over they whipped him. His back soon laid in long shreds of tissue. His front a bruised mass. And then to make things worse, they mock him. They put a woolen blanket on him. And they plait a crown, this time of thorns, and they press it into his head. And they give him a reed as his staff. But then they take the reed and they hit him about the head, driving the thorns in deeper. And then, of course, you know what happens when you put a piece of cloth on an open wound and you pull it off. And so they take this robe and take it from him and put his own clothing back on. From having no sleep, going through five trials, and now going through this scourging, when it's time to finally send him out to be crucified, he can't even make it the 650 yards between the praetorium and the cross. And that's when they ask Simon the Cyrene to step in and take care of it. Now, we need to think of the cross a little bit differently. We need to think of it in the as a T and not as a cross piece like we have it. The stipe piece, the upright, was kept in the ground all the time. It was up there at Golgotha. But what they called the platybulum, about 100 to 110 pound piece of lumber, that was carried by the person to be crucified from the praetorium up to Golgotha. And as we said, Jesus couldn't do it. And so as he fell, Simon was put in his place. They took those up, and what would happen then is they would throw the platybulum on the ground. Then they would throw the prisoner on top of the platybulum. And they would take his one arm and stretch it all the way to the side. And they would put right in this area, because this is where the carpal bones are. I know it says in the scriptures hand, but both scientifically, medically, and grammatically, the wrist has always been considered a part of the hand. If you put it up here, it would go right through the metacarpals and right out. So you put it up here where the bones are all various sizes and shapes, and they won't give. Now, there's a little problem when you go through the carpal bones right at that spot. There are three nerves that come down the human arm. One is the ulnar, the other is the radial, and the third is the median. And the median goes right through that area. Of course, they put the stake there by obvious reason. These were 8-inch pins. They were squared up with a point. Then they would take the other arm and put it to the other side. Then they'd raise up the platybulum and drop it into place. Now, where we get the idea that the cross actually goes up beyond that is then they'd put the sign up of the charges. You remember Jesus' sign said, "The King of the Jews," in three different languages. The Pharisees didn't like that, but Pilate was like, tough. Then they would take the feet, cross them over each other, go through the arches, and nail the feet to the cross. And then would begin the agony of the cross. Of course, you're hanging there. And as you hang, of course, that nerve is being stimulated. The pain that you are feeling literally crashes into your skull. You put up with it as long as you can. But as you're hanging down, of course, you're sliding down, you're trying to push yourself up. Of course, that back is now being rubbed against that wood because they take all the clothes off before they put you on the cross. As he's trying to breathe, it's getting more difficult. Because of the loss of blood and the extreme pain, after a time, his intercostal muscles will begin to cramp. And he'll be able to get air in, but not able to blow it back out. Eventually, he'll pass out. And when he does, he'll breathe again. But now he's down, and to get the pain off his arms, he'll push himself up by his feet. Both the intermediate and the median costal nerves go through that very area of the foot. This is the fun part for me because I get to resurrect my veterinary training. Again, the same concept though. One nail for both feet, but the same concept. As he pushed up, of course, again, there would be the pain. And he could only endure that so long, but he could at least breathe. But eventually, it would be too much. He would sag back down on the arms. Eventually, the whole process with the loss of fluids and the pain and everything would again cause cramping, and again he would be shut down in his breathing, and he would pass out, and then air would come back in. He was on the cross for 6 hours, up and down, up and down, up and down. That's why they broke the legs of the two thieves, because you see, they wanted to get them off of there before the Passover. So they broke their legs so then they could not push themselves up and breathe, and they would literally suffocate. For the second half of that 6 hours, the final 3 hours, darkness came upon the earth. Now, we're talking about noon to three. When is it brightest around here? About noon to three. And yet there was darkness. There was an earthquake. As he gave up the ghost, the veil that separated the holy from the holy of holies was torn from top, God's side, to the bottom, symbolizing free access into the presence of God of all men because of what Christ did on Calvary. It says that at the end of that 6 hours, they broke the legs of the two thieves, but they did not break Jesus' legs. Again, because of prophecy, no bone would be broken. But just to assure themselves, they stuck a spear in his side. And we know that water and blood came out. Part of the problem you have is water begins to collect in your, or serum begins to collect in the pericardium surrounding the heart. So your heart's now finding it more difficult to pump. All of that contributing so that at the end of the 6 hours, he said, "Into thy hands I commit my spirit." And he breathed his last. Going with the thought of John chapter 10 where he says, "I have the power to lay down my life. I also have the power to take it up again." Christ died willingly on that cross. Now, some have said, well, how could one man's death on a cross be enough to cover the sins of all mankind? And people miss that it's not the quantity of sacrifice, but the quality of the sacrifice. This was the Son come, taken upon human flesh, so he became the God-man. This was deity on the cross of Calvary, as well as humanity. This was absolute innocence, not particular area innocence. This was precious blood. In fact, what is the most precious element known to man? Some would say silver, some would say gold, some would say platinum. It's blood. Blood is the most precious element. And this was truly precious blood, because this came from one who had no sin. When they've done all of this, then they take him down from the cross. Joseph of Arimathea asked for his body. Nicodemus, the late night inquirer of Jesus, is along with him, as are the women, Mary Magdalene, Salome. And they are going to put him in Joseph of Arimathea's grave. Again, a fulfillment of Isaiah 53, where he would be in a rich man's tomb. Now, how many of you know on the Wyomissing Circle the big gray house with the iron fence around it? You've seen that big, huge gray house. How many of you have seen that? Okay, it's several hands. How many of you remember what my first house looked like? I want to note that this is a prominent gravesite. This is not a, what is it? Tom, Dick, and Harry? This isn't a poor man's gravesite that's back in the main part of the cemetery. This is a special gravesite. That'll be important because the women get to the right grave. Now, before they put them in, they take long linen cloths and they wrap the body. You know, they put the arms down to the side, feet together, and they begin to wrap the body from the shoulders down. Wrapping after wrapping, putting in things, putting in various things like myrrh and incense to try to, in there, obviously to keep some of the smell down, but to anoint the body with. They put those on. We know that the scholar Gamaliel had some 75 pounds worth of this stuff put on him. So we're assuming maybe because of the love and care of Joseph of Arimathea and the others, it may have been as much as 100 pounds of this put on. Then they placed him on the ledge inside the grave, put over a head cover, and then they closed the grave. Now, we close graves around here by throwing dirt in on top. But there, they were caves, and they had stones that they would put in there. One stone, perhaps weighing anywhere between 2,000 and 4,000 pounds. It would be wedged. It would have a little trough that it would follow down so that the weight and the momentum of the stone would lodge it into the hole sufficiently to seal it off. And they did all this, and then they went to the upper room where they, in absolute terror, spent the next 3 days and three nights. Then Sunday came. They had forgotten all about Sunday. Actually, they didn't understand from Jesus about Sunday. But Sunday came. The women are the first to go. And they come upon the grave. And one of the things they say on their way, because you see, they've got more spices and stuff that they want to put on the body. One of the things they say on the way to the grave, how are we going to get somebody to move the stone for us? Now, they did have a prospect, because you see, the Jews were concerned that the stone would be opened in the grave, that something would be taken from the grave by the disciples. So they asked Pilate for a guard. Now, one of these guards is 16 men, usually. They are trained to defend 3 square feet of space. And by the way, they work as a unit. If one man would become a coward and fail to do his job, all 16 would be killed. So they were very concerned, not only that they did their job, but that everyone around them did their job as well. And they sealed the tomb, long leather straps that went across the tomb, and then a seal put in the middle. Now, when I was a kid, the girls loved to do that. They would have these little metal things. They put the wax on the back of the paper, and then they could put the little thing in. I don't think that's done much anymore. Some of you have perhaps gotten things notarized, and there's a seal that's put on. We have a seal here to show our corporate status. But what it told everybody is, this is Rome. This is not your normal local constable. This is Rome. This is closed by Rome. It would be terrifying for anyone to open that seal. And then you had the guard outside it. So perhaps they thought maybe they could get the guard to help them to move the stone. But when they came, they found the guard amazed and stunned off to the side. And the stone rolled away. And an angel on top of the stone. By the way, the angel did not roll the stone back to let Jesus out. He rolled the stone back to let the women and Peter and John in. Now the ladies look in there, and here's what they see. They see the covering of Jesus still in place. The headscarf is taken away, neatly folded to the side. We would expect the Lord to have OCD. Those of us who have OCD. But the body was gone. And so they went running back and told the disciples. Now, the disciples argued with them. It couldn't be true. See, these guys were not expecting the resurrection. So Peter and John take off for the tomb. And from what we can hear from John's gospel, John was a little faster than Peter. So he got there first. And John is more the academic. So John walks up to the tomb and looks in and begins to kind of scan the insides. And you can see it in his gospel. He walks you through that. Peter, as Peter is prone to do, just bursts into things, goes slamming right by John into the tomb. But they both find the same thing. They go back and tell the disciples. And then they get the message from the women that they're to go to see Jesus. So first thing they find is the stone is aside. The guard is amazed. Now, remember what happens if one of these guys fails in his duty? For all of them. Same thing for the centurion who had to determine that Jesus was dead. So they went to the Jewish leaders that had requested them and told them the situation. Well, the Jewish leaders didn't want that to come out. And so they paid off the guards, concocted a story, and then they were going to go to Pilate and those in charge and make it okay with them. So not only do we find the stone aside, we have the guards are amazed, and the body is absent. And then the Lord begins to appear. He appears, first of all, to Mary Magdalene. Then he appears to the disciples, except for one guy. Remember, we got the doubting Thomas to deal with. Then he appears to Thomas and the other disciples. Eventually, he will begin to appear on a regular basis to the disciples. One, in John 21, he's actually got a fish fry going for them when they come in. So this is no spirit. This is no Casper the Friendly Ghost type. This is a physical being. And they come in and they handle him. The ladies handle him. Remember, Thomas wanted to put his hand in the holes of the nails and in the space of the spear. Eventually, Paul will tell us in 1 Corinthians 15 that as many as 500 brethren saw Jesus. Now, he's writing 1 Corinthians probably about 25 years after Jesus was crucified. And he says, to further bolster his case, most of the 500 are still alive. In other words, you can go and ask them if what I'm telling you is true. This is good evidence for a court, isn't it? Wouldn't you like to go to court with 500 witnesses? That's a pretty good deal. Then you put in all the evidence of the tomb. Maybe you get one of the Roman soldiers to crack, and you've got a case that's solid. In fact, one of your witnesses is going to be the Apostle Paul. Now, Paul met Jesus, the resurrected Jesus, on a trip to Damascus to further persecute believers. So what we have here is what you might call a hostile witness. He not only didn't believe in the resurrection, but he was doing everything he could to do about these Christians who were hanging around. And he came to know him and became a witness of the resurrection. In fact, that's one of the things that's really interesting, isn't it? These folks are hiding in the upper room until Sunday. And after Sunday, they become the mighty 11 disciples. Eventually, they get a 12th, and then Paul, who turned the world upside down. Now, many men have died for a lie. But not because they didn't know it was a lie. A man will not give his life away for a lie. These men went to the death based on their convictions, not on their concoctions. Now, how do we answer it? How do we explain it away? Certainly this can't be true, the devil tells us. Unbelieving people tell us it's just a bunch of baloney. Well, let's think it through. Let's look at some of the theories that have been put forth. The first one is the setup theory, that they drugged Jesus before he went to the cross. He succumbed on the cross, not dying, was put in the tomb. There in the cold, damp tomb, the drug wore off, he revived, and he came out. Now, there's a couple of problems with that. Can't you see it? One is, think of all he went through. Do you think a drug is going to help him get through all that? Secondly, how does one man move a stone of 2,000 to 4,000 pounds from the inside? Thirdly, how does he leave the grave clothes all nicely put out there? What do? Like a worm kind of slither out of it? And then when he appeared to the disciples with all the wounds and all the weakness that he had, how would he appear as the Lord of glory and change their hearts to take over the world? Not going to happen. Now, someone has taken that a little differently. Hugh Schoenfield wrote a book, The Passover Plot, and he says that Jesus swooned. Yeah, he kind of went into a coma there for a while. And so they got him off the cross. Didn't break his legs, good thing. But in this coma, he was put in the tomb and then eventually revived. But again, faces the same problems. How do you move the stone? How do you get out of the wrappings and leave them all still in place? How do you appear as the Lord of glory? It was funny. There was a lady who called into a Bible talk show run by a fellow by the name of Charlie. And the lady said, my pastor doesn't believe that Jesus died. They believe he believes that he swooned. And so they put him in the grave, and then after a time in the grave, then he came out alive. And so Charlie wrote back to her and said, I'll tell you what let's do. Why don't we give your pastor 39 whippings with a cat of nine tails? Let's let him carry a 110-pound piece of lumber, 650 yards. Let's put him on a cross driving nails through his wrists and his feet, leave him there for 6 hours, and at the end of 6 hours, poke a spear in his side, then take him down, wrap him with the wrappings, put him in the grave, and let's just step back and find out what happens. Well, you know what happens. He's dead. And nothing happens. Then there's the stolen body theory. Remember, the original reason for the Roman guard was that the disciples would steal the body. Now, first of all, these disciples, where are they right now? In terror, in an upper room, afraid they might be coming after them. Okay. These brave boys are going to come down and take care of the Romans? Secondly, the disciples didn't believe in the resurrection anyway yet. So why would they want to steal the body? And thirdly, are these men going to stand up and proclaim the risen Savior? Remember, Paul got in Dutch there on Mars Hill. They said he preached Jesus and the resurrection. Would he be preaching Jesus and the resurrection if he knew from the other disciples that Jesus had not risen but had been stolen away by the disciples? It's not going to happen. Now, another possibility is that the authorities did it. Maybe the Jewish authorities, maybe the Roman authorities. Christianity soon became a big thorn in the Jewish leader's side and in the Romans. So, what could they do to stop that? Put that body on a cart wheel it through the center of Jerusalem, and the faith known as Christianity would be dead immediately. Do you remember them doing that? No. And then a third theory is that the gardener. Remember, Mary thought that when she saw Jesus, it was the gardener. The gardener did it. He was so tired of all these people tramping through his lettuce that he finally said, look, I've had it. I'm going to take that body out of here and move it. I mean, it makes as much sense as the other ones, doesn't it? Plus, it brought a smile to all your faces. And then there's always the shaken woman theory. We all know that women can't use maps, right? They get lost. And these ladies are emotionally just shaken. And so they probably got to the wrong tomb. You know how women are with directions. Now, I hope you can understand the tone in which I'm saying all these things so you don't beat me out in the foyer assuming that I believe these things. When the body was put in the grave, where were these women? At that grave. Secondly, this is a prominent grave. This is Joseph of Arimathea. Just as many of you knew what the gray house looked like that I talked about, the big mansion with the there on the white missing traffic circle, you didn't know what my old house looked like. Because mine was just a who cares. But when you drive around that white missing traffic circle, I don't know about you, but I always stare at that thing. That is just so cool. I find something new all the time. And I just love staring at it. It's prominent. Joseph of Arimathea had a prominent grave. Not a grave stuck way back in the far corner, but one right up at the front, very near the cross. And the women had been there. And the women make the claim that they did not find a body. Now, if they were at the wrong tomb, wouldn't somebody have moved them over to the right one? The fact of the matter is if it was, as they looked into that tomb, they found no body. They found the body wrappings, but they found no body. And then they left and told Peter and John, and Peter and John, who are men who can use a map, sound, solid-thinking men, not easily shaken by emotion, came to the same grave, didn't they? And found the same situation. So blaming emotional women who didn't manage to get to the right place is foolish. And we could do it then again. If it was that they got to the wrong place, what could the authorities do? Again, put the body on a cart, run that cart through the middle of Jerusalem, kill Christianity in a moment. When we think of all the evidence, quite frankly, it is overwhelming. I know of at least two prominent lawyers from the past who have said they found it the most compelling evidence. They even went so far as to say they have won cases in court with far less evidence than they have about the resurrection. One even went so far as to call it one of the best attested facts in history. So there is one other theory that we can think of, and that's the scripture theory. I mean, how else do you explain all the appearances to the women, to the disciples plus Thomas, eventually to Paul, to as many as 500 people in those 40 days that he was here? Some 500 different disciples saw him. We know that there was 120 of them up in the upper room waiting for the coming of the Spirit because they had been taught by him. What do you do with all those appearances? Easy. We take care of it easy. Hallucination. It's all a big hallucination. But you know something? Hallucinations happen under a couple of circumstances. One, they happen, it's something usually that you want to have had happen. But you see, the disciples were not expecting the resurrection. Therefore, they were not expecting to see Jesus, so why would they hallucinate about it? But secondly, hallucinations are singular. You might be having one right now. You've got the hallucination that you're already out in your house, in your car, driving to the restaurant where you're going to have your Easter dinner, and you're not. But the person next to you is not having the same hallucination. You can't get 500 people to hallucinate about the same thing at the same time. No, there's no way to explain away the appearances. No way to explain away the alterations either. What will happen to all 11 of these disciples? They will give their lives for Jesus. They will give their lives for the Lord Jesus. Now, what changed them from the scaredy cats up in the upper room to the mighty warriors that would take the gospel throughout the world and be called the men who have turned this world upside down? Why would Paul become the man who would be the most feared man in the Roman and Jewish empires? And they wanted him dead so bad. What would explain the alterations in these people's lives? Well, the same thing that would explain the hallucination and appearances. Jesus is alive. Now, I realize this is subjective evidence, but the disciples were changed. Paul was changed. And when you and I believe the gospel, what happened to us? We were changed. Those of you who have been saved a while, have you noticed any difference between what you are now and what you were when you got saved? Attitudes, approaches, all of that has been altered, hasn't it? My brother and I grew up just 2 years apart in the same house with the same discipline, with the same input into our lives. We both went to a state-sponsored college. He to Ball State, me to Purdue. We got married. They had a girl and a boy. We have a girl and a boy. And yet, Meredith's and my lives are radically different. And in fact, my brother and my father both used to tell my wife that she wouldn't have liked me as I was when I was in high school. That I've changed so much since I met Jesus. I was glad for that. But how do you explain away those appearances? How do you explain away those alterations? There is no other method that you can explain them away other than Jesus rose just as he said. W. Robertson Nicole said this: the empty tomb of Christ has been the cradle of the church. In fact, our proper response to a risen Savior was modeled by that man we make fun of all the time, Thomas, when he fell to his knees and said, "My Lord and my God." The disciples were running. Mary was crying. The crowd was wondering. They did not know that Sunday was coming. The world was winning. People were sinning. Evil was grinning. They did not know that Sunday was coming. The disciples are questioning. The Pharisees are celebrating. Pilate is struggling. Satan is laughing. They did not know that Sunday was coming. Hope is lost. Death is won. Sin is conquered. They did not know that Sunday was coming. But up from the grave he arose with a mighty triumph o'er his foes. He arose a victor from the dark domain, and he lives forever with his saints to reign. He arose, he arose, hallelujah, Christ arose, hallelujah, it's Sunday.